Before the show starts, we just wanted to mention a few things for you to think about. Firstly, Peter, Tim and I are amazed at the support we get from you and all of our guests. Thank you so much. But to keep Extended a good listen, we need to carry on attracting top quality guests. And that means demonstrating the power and strength of Extended and its reach into the aerospace world. So please help us grow the number of people listening and grow the number of subscribers to the programme. Tell your friends, put a flyer up on your notice board, or if you have a website or a blog, please feel free to add a link to our show. If you do this, we'll help promote your aerospace blog or your website and can even give you a mention on Extended. If you need a logo or a PDF, just let us know. We have one other request. We love doing this, but obviously it does come at a cost, and we produce Extended entirely from our own resources. If you look at aviation-extended.co.uk, you'll see a whole bunch of Amazon links on there, whether it's for specific products or just to search and buy anything at all. If you are going to use Amazon to make a purchase, whether it's for you or as a gift for a friend, please do so through our website. It costs you nothing extra, and it could help provide us with a modest allowance to help keep Extended sustainable. Without you, we have no programme. So thank you so much for being part of the journey. And if you can help keep us ETOPS, we'd be extremely grateful. Back to the show.
This is XTP Media.
Hello everybody, it's me, Mrs. G, aka Claire Opsbird. You're listening to Extended for the best in aerospace news, views and interviews. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 19 of Extended. And joining me today are my co-presenters, and first we have editor of Global Aviation Resource, Gareth Stringer.
Hi Peter, hello everyone, how are you?
Very good, thank you. And we also have, of course, our editor-in-chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson.
Hello there, hello. Hi everybody.
This program's being supported by Skyrocket Cafe, and we're delighted to have them on board, so please do go and visit them. And in the show today, we talk to Brian Link, who's a director at Slipstream Research, but he's also a UH-60L Black Hawk pilot with a very interesting background. We have the Get Involved segment and, of course, things you never knew about. But as always, let's get started by seeing what interests us in aerospace news. And our first story is all about laser attacks, Gareth. 1,500 last year recorded and logged with the Civil Aviation Authority in the UK. That's five a day.
Yeah, not a news story, but still, you know, a shocking story.
Just a dreadful number. I was genuinely shocked by that number.
I mean, call me old-fashioned, but I just don't understand what the motivation for even doing this could possibly be, to be honest with you. You know, this is this is not a bit of a laugh between friends. This is something that could cause an absolutely horrendous tragedy. Let's face it, there's no, you know, that's kind of the, you know, the awful consequence potentially of doing something like this. It's not just a laugh, you know, and the fact that you can clearly still get hold of these high-intensity laser pens, and, you know, it's one of the stories that I'm looking at in front of me, says for as little as 12 quid.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just absolutely extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, I just would, you know, just question why, you know, why is this happening? And if it's, you know, going to continue to happen, then surely we've got to, you know, come down a lot stronger on the people who are being caught. And, you know, there needs to be a much, much better deterrent to stop this happening.
Yeah, and it's across the whole sector. This isn't just, you know, a few airliners coming into Heathrow. Airports at Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, East Midlands, Bristol, Gatwick, all featured in the report. And a 737 on approach to Birmingham was hit five times, apparently. This is just bonkers.
If you know of anybody that's doing this, just tell them to stop, you know, please.
And grow up.
Yeah.
I think the worrying thing is that, you know, police helicopters, even a transporter carrying back British troops from Afghanistan, injured British troops, was hit by a green laser as it's made its approach into Birmingham. I mean, that's just dreadful. These people should be ashamed of themselves. But as you say, not a new story, but very sad all the same. Let's move on then. The MRJ, Tim, is finally coming together, and I was quite surprised at the number of orders for it already.
You know, this is Japan's regional airliner. It's not as big as a 737 or an A320, but it's a Mitsubishi regional jet. It's slated to fly in 2014 sometime. A little bit of delays with it, but they have got some decent orders with it. It's using the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan, and it's really in that sort of same space as sort of C series. They're all kind of jostling in that sort of that sort of space. So it's going to be interesting. You know, I've had a look at the cabin. It's a very nice sort of cabin mock-up at air shows. But it's entering a very kind of crowded market space.
It's not done bad with those initial orders, though. 165 firm orders. All Nippon Airways are the launch customer with 15. And interestingly, SkyWest in the US has 100.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, that was a big coup for them there to get a buyer from a US airline.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Yeah.
And looking at a recently adopted new aircraft, the 787, which of course never leaves us in the news, but interestingly enough, Norwegian, although they've had their troubles with the 787, are looking to use them long haul, some really cheap fares.
Yeah, I mean, this is exciting news from earlier this month in October, and they're starting off transatlantic flights, flying from Gatwick in the middle of 2014 to London Gatwick to New York and the one way starts from 150 quid, 149 quid, or one way to Los Angeles.
Wow.
So that's pretty competitive. Now, talking to the CEO there, he was very upbeat about the Dreamliner. They had a bit of problems with their one had to be grounded, but he says it's a fantastic aeroplane, and he says that the fuel economy on this is the reason why they're able to do these low fares. That's what they've been kind of waiting for. That was enabled to them to kind of long haul, low cost. They're doing New York, Los Angeles, and also Fort Lauderdale in Florida. From 2014, so really interesting kind of startup. You know, a European budget airliner that's now going long haul.
Yeah.
However, AirAsia X from Malaysia had a try at doing this and going to Gatwick. They had a big launch. They're going to kind of Gatwick from Kuala Lumpur, I think it was. Couldn't make it work. They were flying A330s. So right. Previous generation of aircraft. So, load factor wasn't quite good enough, didn't really make sort of sense. And also, if you look further back in history, obviously Freddie Laker and Skytrain.
Yeah.
So those are people with old enough or with long enough memories or good access to Google and a few books will remember that how the established legacy sort of airlines would respond to that. So that's another interesting one to watch. Can they make it work? What a BA, what are the rival airlines, American Airlines, for example, Virgin, you know, what are they going to do to respond? What to look out for?
Yeah. And talking about load factors, Russian carrier Transaero has some A380s on order and is apparently going to kit them out at 652-seaters in three classes. Now, that's not going to be apparently the highest capacity. There's an airline called Air Austral in the French territory of Reunion. Apparently, he's ordered an 840-seat A380, which they've got some financial trouble, so I'm not quite sure that one will ever see the light of day. But 652, very realistic. They're going to put it in on their routes to Thailand from Moscow and to the Dominican Republic. So fancy sitting on an aircraft with another 650 people?
Well, I mean, you know, you've got to remember that the A380s is so big that the airlines that are using it now, for example, you know, Emirates, Etihad, they're really able to go to town on the premium and the business class and even the economy class, you know, give the economy class. So everyone's getting kind of a bit more space than usual. And, you know, you've got these great, fantastic kind of first class kind of pods and, spaces where the bar areas is. So there is an argument that some, you know, from some people saying, well, you know, once the kind of novelty dies down a bit, people will start saying, well, yeah, you know, this was great to kind of get a few headlines and stuff, but you know what, next refit, I'm gonna actually kind of squeeze a few more seats in there, make more money with it, you know, up the load factors, up the capacity a little bit, and squeeze, you know, put more people in there. It's a bit like how the 747 was kind of marketed with, you know, upstairs sort of deck was going to have like a cocktail bar and a person, somebody playing the piano. You know, looks great in marketing, but actually realistically doesn't work. But I think there's room for it to go bigger than that, you know, if you were for kind of shorter routes, you know.
They're talking about using it possibly on one of the domestic services as well. I mean, obviously domestic services in Russia are relatively long, some of them, but I think they're looking to out towards the Pacific to run them on there if this works. So it'd be quite interesting to see if someone actually really maxes out and utilizes the capacity on the A380.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, then, and moving over to a story that's just breaking as we record, the Taranis. Have we seen it trialled or not?
Right, okay. It depends who you ask. This is an interesting one. Taranis is the UK's unmanned combat demonstrator, a drone in the popular parlance, unmanned sort of stealth bomber, but it's a demonstrator, it's a prototype. Equivalent to X-47B in the US or a France's Neuron. MOD and BAE Systems have to do what MOD says, obviously, but MOD is very, very secretive about it. You know, there was a rollout a few years ago, the press got to see it for the first time, saw it in a hangar, and from that on it was it. And what we know now, what we understand, we've not been told directly, but what we understand is it is in Australia and that it is working up to flight tests at the moment. Now, nobody was being sort of told when the first flight would be or what the flight schedule would be or anything like that, but it was interesting that there was a report to the UK Parliament from the MOD about remotely piloted air vehicles, and one of the key quotes there was, "Taranis ground tests commenced in 2010 and flight trials took place in 2013. Now, obviously, this is the MOD reporting to Parliament, so you would hopefully should expect that should be accurate. So that sounds to me, flight trials took place. That sounds to me like past tense. So, journalists, aviation journalists, defense journalists have been trying to find out, well, does this actually mean that it's flown? Why can't you tell us anymore? You know, surely this is good British UK engineering and technology story. got to the MOD, and they've come back and sort of said, this is the official line. The program continues as Tranis and initial trials program, but it's inappropriate to comment further until the trials are completed. So there you go.
Yeah.
So,
Tim, why would they be testing it in Australia?
Right. Well, you've got to test it where there's no people. First off, there's two reasons. Firstly, is there a safety aspect. You want a nice big airspace to go at where there's nobody going to be around that you can. If anything goes wrong, you've got a nice big test range. So, it's either US or Australia for that. And the second one is. Security. They are very, very, you don't want sort of prying eyes on it. So having it there where there's no one around keeps it away from people taking pictures of it. Now, you could sort of say, well, hang on, the French released pictures of theirs. The Americans have actually invited journalists to see the X-47 land on an aircraft carrier. How secret can this thing be? So you could argue the point there. So it's a tricky one, really. As the sort of aviation press, we'd like to know more. We'd like to kind of flag it up. MOD obviously playing it very, very close to their cards, close to their chest. They want to sort of come out with a story when it's fully formed, when it's done all the tests, and they can sort of say it's done X, Y, and Z. And also there is this sort of thing now of the anti-drone brigade or the killer drones stuff. So maybe part of it as well is they didn't want to publicise it too much just in case somebody went down to Australia, glued themselves to an airbase runway or chain themselves to some gate or something like that. And then you've got the whole thing of how do we get this person off the property when we're trying to do some testing. So there might be a bit of that as well. But, it's a little bit frustrating,
It does seem a bit over the top, as you say, given some of the publicity around other nations' unmanned vehicles. But yeah, there you go.
If I was betting, I'd probably say it has flown and they're just waiting for the initial, kind of results to come in.
Yeah.
Having said that, it might just be a cock-up on the part of, the wording on the report. They wrote it ahead of the time and thought, by the time we write this, it will have flown. It got locked in the, this report has been kind of circulating and being amended and approved and all the rest of it. And it went round and it took so long. It's come out now and it's a little bit sort of jumped the gun a little bit, So there you have it.
Okay, we'll leave the news there. After the break, we'll hear from Brian Link, who's a UH-60 pilot, V-22 crew chief, engineer and pilot, as well as having time on the UH-1 and the Sea Knight.
Game challenge begins. Launch. Circular orbit. Rapid rendezvous. Intercept and dock with International Space Station.
All engine running. Lift off.
Push the ISS to higher orbit. Rescue EVA astronauts. Avoid space debris. Destroy debris with missiles. Protect the ISS for as long as possible. Deorbit. Land. Survive.
All in a day's work.
We had a pretty large bank.
We've had a problem here.
Post control, both autos, these are next command override off.
We've had shutdown.
Leo, low Earth orbit. A game from skyrocketcafe.com.
We're sitting in corner, right? Holding short on taxiway golf. Two aircraft behind us. The controller comes back and tells the traffic behind us. The Alpine traffic in front of you hasn't called you for takeoff. Can you taxi around? And the taxiway is always so big, it's not big enough for something to taxi around. And then the guy goes, no. So as soon as he says no, I turn around and say, hey, Alpine, 480 is ready to take off. You know what this knucklehead tells me? Say, hold short, traffic landing. Yeah, but he was a fucking Cessna about 5 miles out. I should have just sat there for another 5 minutes because there was like two airplanes behind us. But that's, you know, just again, that controller, just that one controller up there, Ted is his name. You know, that guy's a jackass. Hey, man, I called his boss on him before, man. Really? Yeah, there was one time, I was, you know, he cleared me for takeoff just as soon as I left the cargo ramp. So I'm going through my checklist, doing everything. And, you know, the taxi, the takeoff point's like a 3/4 mile up the road, you know, up the taxiway. So by the time I get there, I said, fine, whatever, my tail number is, just confirm we're still close to takeoff. He comes back over the radio, like, Alpine, you know, tail number, you are cleared for takeoff, like I'm an idiot. Hold short. Then I took off, and then I called the supervisor when I got on the ground the following day.
Now, the quality of this recording was very, very poor. Brian persevered with us. We made, I think, about 8 or 9 phone calls to him that night. He was located in a remote part of Germany. So we do apologise about the quality, but we really thought that the content was well worth listening to. Brian, welcome to Extended.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a delight to have you on the show, but let's start by having a look at your CV. A background in aeronautical engineering, you're qualified in the US defense acquisitions process. You've got extensive maintenance and flight testing experience on the V-22, 2100 hours on fixed and rotary wing aircraft, including powered lift, pilot flight time in the V-22. You hold a Master of Aeronautical Science from Embry-Riddle with a core emphasis in air vehicle design and flight testing. You spent 9.5 years in the US Marines as a crew chief and mechanic on the Sea Knight, and then as a crew chief and mechanic on the MV-22B Osprey. You've also flown the UH-1N and worked as an experimental flight test engineer at Naval Air Station Patuxent River. A little spell out then with Bell Helicopters, and now you're back with the US Army and you're a pilot on the UH-60L Black Hawk. But not sufficient with all of that as your day job, you're also vice president and technical director for a group called Slipstream Research, where you're designing and building 2 aircraft for the general aviation market. Brian, I'm staggered. I don't know where to start. So, Brian, how did you get interested in flying? Where did the journey begin?
My passion for aviation started basically when the space shuttle started flying back in 1981. I remember being glued to the TV screen, and the rest is history. I wasn't even 4 years old, and I at that point I knew what I had to do.
Right. And so from 4 through to Embry-Riddle, how did you actually get into flying?
I did my, there was a little airport just down the way from where I grew up, Cable Airport in Upland, California, and they did the half-hour scenic flight in a little Cessna 172, and had the opportunity, sitting up front with the pilot. You know, he hands the controls over to me and says, you know, you have the controls. You know, I was like, oh, this is so cool. You know, and it vindicated my passion even up to that point. Now, years down the road, come 1996. I actually started doing flying lessons, and then just started moving up from there.
You went into the military. You joined the U.S. Marines first, didn't you?
I did.
And you became a crew chief and a mechanic on the Sea Knight, the CH-46E. What was that like?
It was really interesting, very interesting experience, because in the Marine Corps, the entire crew chief training track is actually about 1.5 years long. So you start by, after you go through boot camp and you go through basic infantry school, you move on to what they call Naval Air Crew Candidate School at Naval Air Station Pensacola in Florida. So you're with a bunch of Navy guys as well, and you basically spend 4 weeks doing very intensive physical and swim training, and you go through all the aerospace medicine, such as the, you go through the centrifuge, you go through the hyperbaric chamber. So the whole time, you know, I thought that was really cool. I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm actually getting paid to do this, right? And then and then after that, you go on to SEER school, which is Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, which, you know, a very eye-opening experience. Went through that in northeastern Maine in the middle of winter. I highly recommend it. a great vacation, great time for it. But after that, moved on to Marine Corps Air Station New River in North Carolina, where you go through, if I remember right, it's an 8-week mechanic course. So you learn how to be a basic flight line mechanic on the aircraft. In the school, you do basic maintenance tasks like remove and reinstall an engine, remove and reinstall a transmission, and you learn the basic nomenclature of the aircraft, basic systems. And just when you thought you had a handle on the aircraft, we go out to Marine Corps Air Station Camp Pendleton, where we went through the crew chief training course, which was a 14-week, very intensive course where you start going through flying, you go through very intensive academics. At one point along the course, at week 10, the instructor takes you out to an aircraft and you have to identify every single part and piece on that aircraft. And then at week 12, I mean, up on top of doing all your flying qualifications, you have to go through a systems examination. So you have to be able to explain, okay, hey, here is the engine, here's how it works, or here's the automatic flight control system, here's how it works.
You then went on to the UH-1, the November model.
Actually, the UH-1 was later on in my career. I went to the B-22 after C-46, but basically in 2004, I did the transition from the CH-46 to the B-22, and talk about a completely different animal. I mean, yeah, it takes off vertically, but that's just about where the similarity ends.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Osprey then. Did you you actually spent a bit of time with the aircraft before you left to join Bell Helicopters?
Oh yeah. I spent the second half of my Marine career, about 5 years and change, around the aircraft. So when I was on that aircraft, I was trained up as a mechanic, trained up as a crew chief, later became a standardization crew chief instructor at the schoolhouse, teaching the young kids coming through and some of the not so young, because all the transition, all the units that were transitioning from the CH-46 to the B-22 interfaced with me at one point. Matter of fact, I guess my little claim to fame with that is the very first unit, very first B-20, or the very first CH-46 unit to transition to the B-22 that ultimately went to Iraq in 2007. I was their lead instructor on it. Yeah, it was a really interesting time. Because when I joined the program back in early 2004, I remember seeing only two aircraft on station at New River, because that's in North Carolina. That's where we all were. And then the aircraft wasn't even operational yet. So we were still going through a period called operational evaluation, which is kind of like the final big series of tests before the aircraft is declared operational. So, as such, the aircraft was still developmental at the time, per se. So there are a lot of additional maintenance tasks that we were doing, a lot of additional long hours. I mean, even though we only had two, and eventually we got more and more aircraft as time progressed, but having to do all these extra maintenance tasks in addition to us really not knowing how to work on this aircraft. I mean, the CH-46 community, you know, an aircraft that's been around, forever, kind of like the Sea King over in the UK. You always have, you know, the old crusty, you know, senior sergeant, you know, to go turn to, be like, I don't know how to do this, and he'll be like, oh, hey, here's how you do it. So here we were trying, you know, to figure this out for the first time, and it was an eye-opening experience, to be honest with you.
What was that like for you, working on an aircraft that that you didn't know a great deal about, was very new. You didn't know any of the nuances. The pilots were new, and the whole airframe structure was very different to anything that had been in any military force before. What was that like, coming from something like the Sea Knight and then having to work with an aircraft like that?
Well, the interesting thing about it is when you're dealing with a new system or something that unique, you basically have to rely on what the senior engineers and technicians are telling you. I mean, when the aircraft was brand new and we were attached to it initially, we had a lot of very senior mechanics from Bell and Boeing assisting us. But there were a lot of occasions where we were trying to do a maintenance task and they're just like, dude, I don't have the first clue of how to do this, and we had to figure it out. So, but really the big thing, since obviously safety was a prime concern, we flew the aircraft, we operated it very conservatively. Everything it's all autonomously monitored by the aircraft's computer systems, similar to what the jetliners have and things like that. So, in essence, the aircraft will tell on itself. So whenever you're done with a flight, if something exceeds a parameter, it will automatically generate a maintenance work order. But as such, with the aircraft's main software load, at that time, you power up the aircraft, and sometimes it'll tell you that all kinds of things are wrong and wacky with the aircraft, and we end up removing generators, engines, all kinds of things, and send them direct to the manufacturer. And they're like, well, there's really nothing wrong with it. So ultimately, when they modify the software, there's like they take those data channels, and expand those thresholds. And a lot, like we actually saw it where we had at one time, we had a mission readiness rating of about 10%, which means at 10 attempts, only one aircraft made it out. But then there was a software update, and it literally went from 10% to 80% overnight.
Wow.
Just because now they know it's like, okay, the engines can go, the engines can vibrate, they can have a certain vibration threshold of this much, or the transmissions can tolerate this, or certain things can tolerate certain things. So it eventually got easier, but it was a very, it was very humbling. Now, you really had to, be patient, and just basically have faith and hire, which I learned, later on when I made it up to the flight test world. And a lot of things came full circle.
Well, tell us a little bit, Brian, about what it's like to be on board the aircraft. I mean, it's a very unusual concept of vertical to horizontal and vice versa. What is it like to fly on?
The best way that I can really summarize it is if you have a crew of two pilots that know what they're doing, you can be in like your 10-foot, in ground effect hover with like 20 passengers on board. And if they know how to jockey those nacelles correctly, you can be in that 10-foot hover. 10 seconds later, you're already doing 220 knots while doing a 5,000 foot per minute rate of descent. I mean, the aircraft will take off like a bat out of hell.
I mean,
the first time I flew on it, it's almost like tantamount to that one scene in the movie Spaceballs where they go to ludicrous speed and the guy is hanging on for dear life. I mean, because in the CH-46, I was used to just shuffling right along at 90 knots.
Sure.
And now here I am, first time flying on B-22. We're like booking it over the treetops at 230 knots, and I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool.
Well, what's one of the things that is an obvious question is, what's the process of transition? What do you have to go through on the flight deck to transist from horizontal to vertical flight?
Basically, what happens is when you start bringing those nacelles down, it's like putting forward cyclic into a helicopter. That rotor disc is going to tilt forward, but this time it's just the entire nacelle, engine and transmission assembly.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, the aircraft's going to dip down, so they're having to put in a lot of aft stick, you know, to compensate for it.
Right.
But you have to be very gingerly about it. I mean, those nacelles can move as much as 8 degrees per second if you put that. There's like a little thumb wheel on the throttle control that allows you to move the nacelle. But by the time you get to about 30 degrees nacelles, like 30 degrees from horizontal, you're effectively like in wingborne flight. So the aircraft's going to start to climb again because the wing's starting to, you know, to take the load. And then next thing you know, you're down to airplane mode, and the engines will automatically spin down to about 84% rotor speed to give a little bit more efficient cruise. Now, but going back to the helicopter, or the VTOL mode, as we call it, that is a much more dynamic scenario, because basically what happens from that point is, you know, you start bringing the nacelles up, and that thrust vector starts pushing down on the horizontal stabilizer, so the nose is going to want to pull up big time, so they're putting in a bunch of forward stick for it. But it takes some getting used to.
How does one get used to it? Did you have to spend a lot of sim time acclimatizing yourself?
Oh, the pilot, their training program for like the new pilots, basically the way it, well, actually, regardless if you're a transition or a first time flyer on this thing, you're going through some fairly extensive simulator time. And don't quote me, but I think you do somewhere upwards of about 50 to 60 hours in the simulator before you even take that first flight. Having the chance to fly it myself, you know, a couple of years ago, I was like, sure. I was like, wow, because I had spent some time in simulators in the past, and I was just like, I mean, I was able to figure it out, and at that time, you know, I was just your basic, you know, Cessna 172 and basic multi-engine pilot, and I was, so here I am flying the B-22, and I'm just like, wow, this is easy. If I can figure it out, anybody can. Very easy aircraft to fly.
So, Brian, we have a question in from one of our listeners, from listener Julie, and she asks, does the Osprey have any vices, or is it rock solid to fly?
It is a rock solid aircraft, mechanically, hydraulically, very solid aircraft, built like a tank. It can take just about anything that you throw at it.
One of our listeners wants to know what the most hairiest or scariest situation you've been in a rotorcraft.
About the scariest instance that I've had, dated back, I believe it was 2002. I was still a CH-46 crew chief at the time, and we were on our way back from a training exercise. We had a compressor stall, you know, we had a compressor surge, the engine rolled offline, and me and this other mechanic, who was also a crew chief, we went to the back of the engine section. The engines on the CH-46 are inboard. So we're just like, okay, we're just going to take a peek into the engine bay. But the pilot was so wrapped up in, you know, getting the aircraft back to base. I mean, we were in a good single engine profile. Everything was fine. But he elected to do what they de-armed, what they called the emergency throttle system on that aircraft. The aircraft no longer has it, but basically it's a system that just pours more fuel into the engine as, you know, in an attempt to try to get some control. And essentially what happened was a very severe fire broke out. I had first and almost second degree burns on the parts of my skin that were exposed. I did not know the extent of the burns until, you know, I got on the ground, because my focus was, hey, we need to get on the ground right now. We landed in a farmer's field. The funny part of that was that there was this guy on a tractor, you know, tilling up his field. He was approaching us when we landed, and he just, like, steered around the aircraft and just continued doing his thing, didn't faze him one bit. But obviously at that point, you know, my priority was getting the passengers off safely, getting the aircraft shut down, secured safely. You know, it got the heart racing a little bit because we did have that brief fire. But once we got on the ground and shut down, everything was fine. It turned out that when I looked into the engine exhaust section, there was just a pile of what was left over of the power turbine section, and one of those turbine blade fragments I still carry around in my flight bag nowadays is a good luck charm.
Wow. Okay, Brian, as if you don't have enough to do, as I said, you're a senior executive at Slipstream Research. Tell us about your four-place general aviation aircraft. What's going to differentiate it from the current market?
The big difference, the necessity in which we developed the aircraft, came out of a simple fact that you have your Cessna 172s and your Piper Cherokees and stuff that are still being sold. They're legacy platforms. But these aircraft are upwards of $500,000 plus. And in addition, they have four seats, but you cannot put four people in these aircraft. And as such, the engines are still relatively inefficient. So I was thinking, you know, that there's got to be a better way to do this. So what we came up with, and we were just touring around, I've always been a fan of the flying wing concept, and I studied it extensively in engineering school. Just because I felt it was simpler, if that kind of makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And what we ultimately want to do, what we penned up on paper, was an aircraft that we believe is more efficient, has a better useful load, has a better range, and as such, given the nature of the design, will be inherently less expensive to operate and maintain.
Right. Okay. I mean, one of my colleagues, co-presenters, described it as the budget stealth bomber. Does sort of tongue in cheek? Does some of your military experience and what you've seen there, are you able to take that and really apply it here, or is this purely an engineering exercise looking for the most efficient wing platform on which to base the aircraft?
We have designed this aircraft with military crashworthiness standards in mind. It's going to basically have the same, or a little bit better, should I say, crash survivability than your typical four-place general aviation aircraft. But that's pretty much where the similarities end as far as military takeover, or as far as military transfer. You will not have anything to worry about. I mean, this will have winglets on it, so it won't be a pure flying wing per se. And our design does not require added directional stability that the winglets would offer, but the winglets are more or less there for better airflow management, to cut down on flat plate drag, adding to the efficiency that the additional yaw or directional stability is just added value.
Right, okay. So where's the design now, and what stage are you at? When can we maybe look to see the aircraft in the flesh?
Right now we're simply in the process of sourcing components, because there's a couple components like the main wing spar and certain things that we do not have the capability to manufacture, because we have just about zero manufacturing capability. Right now, once we start getting the main parts done, like the wing spar and things like that, this aircraft will come together in very short order.
Okay, we're very excited about seeing this this aircraft. Is there anything that we can find out about it online?
Right now, we're just because of where we're at in the stage of development, we're keeping everything somewhat low key in line with our other projects that we have going. We want to wait till we have something, should I say, a little bit more quantified, like something physical that's a show for us.
Brian, just before we go, one final question. One of my co-presenters has asked me to ask you, and that's what do you think your biggest challenge will be in getting this aircraft to market? Do you think it will be certification costs?
We learned a long time ago that certification is a very lengthy and very expensive endeavor. Ultimately, you know, the end game, you know, years down the road will be to have a certificated platform. But we think probably one of a lower risk venture would be to ultimately market this aircraft in a kit form. And that way, what we want to do is we want to have active participation by all the builders and operators out there. And, you know, maybe they're going to see certain things. They're going to learn certain things that we did not. We're going to have, you know, so we're very much going to encourage technical exchange, because you might never know. They may be like, hey, you know, there is a better way to do this or a better way to do that. If the demand for the kits will be high, then that may justify the additional cost of going through the certification process. But obviously we'd have to become an operation like Burt Rutan over in California to actually have the capability to build the aircraft on a full-time basis.
Well, Brian, that sounds like a really, really exciting project, very fascinating, unique design. It's been a delight to talk to you, to hear all about your experiences and how they've come to fruition in the Slipstream project. Where can we find out about Slipstream on the web?
We have a small basic site. You can type in slipstreamresearch.wordpress.com, and that will get you onto our page. And what we try to do is we do a monthly press release that we push out there. And we're trying, a month and a half ago, we published it in English, German, Romanian, and Czech. But we've learned with that website that there is interest out there. So we're channeling our languages down to that to try to get the word out there. But, you know, it's one of those, you know, one step at a time. So that's all you can do.
Well, listen, Brian, thank you so much for joining us and persevering with what has proved to be a very challenging line. Amazing background, very exciting project. Thank you so much for taking your time out to join us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Anytime.
Peter, where to start? I think that was my overwhelming reaction to that is that, yeah, this is a guy who's out there and he's still, you know, he's still working, but that has already been a life very well lived, hasn't
yes.
it? I mean, crikey, is there anything he hasn't done? That might be the best place to start.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was so much to talk to him about, and I'm sure Brian will come back onto the show at some time. So I'm sure we could pick up a little bit more off of Brian. So if you did enjoy that but wanted to find out a little bit more, drop us a line and we'll see if we can get Brian back onto the show with a better quality line. The Osprey, awesome aircraft, and very lucky to have worked on it. But I thought it was really interesting where he was talking about engineering the aircraft, but they had no experience. They didn't have any manufacturer data or anything, and the readiness of the aircraft literally went up overnight when they upgraded the software, and they hadn't done anything. It was just bizarre. So really interesting. I thought the other thing that I was really intrigued to talk to Brian about, and we did talk a little bit more about this, but unfortunately the line quality was too poor to use, and that was the transition from horizontal to vertical flight and how the pilot goes about doing that. And I think the point he did make was that the nacelles can rotate 8 degrees a second, which is pretty fearsome stuff. So really enjoyed speaking to Brian. Unfortunately, the line was very bad, and we will try and get Brian back onto the show, particularly to talk to him as well about his work with Slipstream, because not only is he flying missions as a UH-60 pilot, he is also developing general aviation aircraft as well. I think, Tim, you described it as the what was it, the civil B-2 or something?
Oh, he got something there for a blended wing body?
Yeah, that's right. So be interesting to see how that evolves along with his day job. So we thank Brian very much for persevering, and we'll see if we can get him back on the show. Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Gnat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this.
Orlando Tower, connection 429 right base for 35 right. We've got the Boeing in sight for 35 left.
Base 429, let us air, 35 right, clear for the option. Give you multiples if you like.
35 right, clear for the option, and we'll take the multiples. Connection 429.
Roger, after this one, make right close traffic.
After this one, make right close traffic. Connection 429.
What's your type aircraft? You a Cirrus?
Cirrus, SR20, correct.
Right. Base 429, after this option, just sit straight out and I'll figure out what I'm going to do. I may give you a left close, so I'll let you know here in a minute. And then would you like multiple runways, or do you want to stay on 35 right?
We could do multiple runways. We'll say straight out off after this one, connection 429.
All right, thanks. Connection 429, you make a left turn for a right downwind to runway 35 left.
I will make a left turn for a right downwind for 35 left, connection 429.
Okay, just make a left turn for a left downwind. I'm going to look for quite a little easier for you.
Yeah, that sounds better. I had to think about that in my brain myself.
I was going to keep you a little tight, I think, for the right downwind. So just left traffic for 35 left.
All right, left traffic for 35 left. We'll go right over the tower. Connection 429.
Sounds good. Connection 429, clear for the option 35 left.
Clear for the option 35 left.
Hi, this is Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Each week we bring you Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment covering European aviation. Check us out at airplanegeeks.com. Until then, enjoy Extended.
Things you never knew about. This episode comes from the Space Shuttle. We all know that the Space Shuttle didn't have a crew escape mechanism if anything went wrong. But actually, the first shuttle, which was Columbia, did have ejection seats for the two pilots, John Young and Bob Crippen. These could be used apparently up to 10 kilometres if necessary, but obviously not after that. In fact, any ejection during ascent was almost certainly doomed, as the pilots would, of course, be ejected into the slipstream with the rather enormous rocket blast, so they were not assured a safe exit. However, the ejection seats might well have been useful in the descent phase if there was any problem back in the Earth's atmosphere and, of course, closer to the ground. Also, the reusable solid rocket booster engines, which we played you the sound of, these falling back to Earth in episode 17, were not unique to a particular shuttle orbiter and so were used across the whole fleet. In fact, some had very slight variations and therefore performance dynamics that NASA could use for particular missions. Now, the original orbiters had 5 computers to run the flight systems, but these didn't have enough memory to hold all the flight data, so a separate memory store was required. To ensure the 5 computers were fully synchronized, they were synced 6 times every second. And finally, did you know that the earlier orbiters did not have full glass cockpits? They actually had a few steam gauges, as we call them, and it was not, in fact, until Atlantis that the cockpit was a full glass cockpit. So there you go, a few things about the shuttle you may not have known about.
Tim, you've got a things you never knew about for us as well.
Yeah, I've got a couple, actually. Well, just thought of one, actually, when you were talking about the space shuttle and survival and kind of like sort of parachute on there. We had a talk at the Aero Society earlier this week from Art Thompson, who is the technical director on Red Bull Stratos, Felix Baumgartner's, you know, sort of record-breaking supersonic parachute skydive, you know, from the edge of space. And very, very interesting lecture, extremely, extremely good sort of technical detail and the research that went into it. It's on YouTube. It's on the Society's YouTube channel. Really good, you know, hour and a bit. Really do recommend people watch it. But one thing he pointed out was, you know, the thing got some flack in some quarters from saying, oh, well, you know, this is just a stunt for an energy drinks company. And one of the things that he said about was that one of the things that affected him was he had, in the aftermath of Columbia breaking up, you know, he'd seen a David Clark pressure helmet, you know, almost the same one that Felix had worn. And, you know, kind of Columbia had broken up, the crew compartment had broken up only 10,000 foot higher than what Felix had jumped from.
Wow.
So... Mm-hmm. You know, his focus was on improving sort of safety, and you know, one day this might be able to save somebody's life.
Yeah.
You know,
sobering.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You know, sorry, I know you've got another one, Tim, but Michael Collins, who was the command module pilot for Apollo 11, his area of expertise when he joined the astronaut program in the 60s was extravehicular activity and also spacesuits. And there was actually a commercial battle that went on between a number of manufacturers to make those suits. And he says at one point he flew 50 hours in 1 month, going from one manufacturer to the other until they could make a decision on which company was going to make the suits for Apollo. And they were handmade by these groups of women who literally they hand stitched those suits. And if they stitched anything wrong, they knew that could result, you know, in tragedy. Absolutely incredible. Yeah. Absolutely incredible.
A stitch anyway, in time.
We digress.
A stitch in time. Sorry, Tim, you had another one for us.
All right. Well, my second things you never knew is the origins of the word drone. Okay, we hear the word drone everywhere. Drone this, drone that. Correctly, you might call it a UAV or a RPA, remotely piloted aircraft, or RPAS, remotely piloted air system, or an RP. Well, you know, it goes on. It changes every so often.
Every week.
Every week. But drone, where does it come from? Well, interesting enough, it comes from a 1935 unmanned aerial vehicle, which was a Tiger Moth converted to aerial target, be an aerial target for the RAF and for you know, sort of the army to give them something to sort of shoot down, and that was the de Havilland 82 Queen Bee. And apparently the US Navy went over there, had a look at it, and they came back and they called it a drone, you know, Queen Bee drone, and the rest is history. And you know, they were called drones, and there were RPVs flying in Vietnam that were called sort of drones. It's only recently now that the sort of terminology has changed, and we're trying to get our heads around the idea of you know, the pilot's not in the aircraft, but it's a little bit more automated than just being a radio controlled model.
It's become a really dirty word, Tim. Drone, hasn't it? Drone is the word that the MOD, you know, don't want people to.
I sympathise with them in some sense with that, because it's not technically correct, and it conjures up all, it's got so much baggage with it.
Yeah.
And the problem with it is the drone can range from anything from something that is the size of a grasshopper to something the size of a 737. The mainstream media, being lazy that they are, they hear the word drone and they will immediately put a picture of a Reaper. And nine times out of ten, it's like a little octocopter thing that is basically like a, you know, radio controlled helicopter, but much more stable, and that somebody's flying in the back garden, you know, something like that. And the thing is, the people can get it, the media can get it right on occasion. There was a terrible incident recently where somebody got unfortunately decapitated in New York by a radio-controlled helicopter. Yeah. And that was reported as radio-controlled helicopter, decapitates hobbyist, you know. So they can get it right. So, yeah, I'm not a big fan of the word drone, you know. Got to be more, start you being more correct.
So, Tim, sorry, this is ridiculous digression again. But this is a brilliant link. When Taranis is introduced to the broader general public, as it undoubtedly will be at some point, do you think that's going to be, Peter, you mentioned it earlier on, incredible British engineering ingenuity, is it going to be a killer? Or do you think it's going to be a killer drone? I suppose it depends which newspaper you choose to read, probably.
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, the problem is people got a little bit confused, I think, with the foreign policy, with the technology. There's plenty of remote systems out there or automated systems that kind of killing from a distance. Well, a sniper does that, you know. Or here's another one for you the idea that the pilots are somehow cowardly sat in a remote thing and they're not going out and fight. Well, you know, they're not, you know, middle ages with crossbows or bows, you know, people made the same arguments. So, I think we should be flagging up Taranis as a good example of British, keeping British military aerospace on the cutting edge of technology, you know. We're not going to be selling this to dodgy regimes. You know, dodgy regimes won't be able to afford the thing in the first place. And, it's keeping us up. It's the natural evolution of, the Spitfire, the Lightning, the Hunter, Typhoon, Tornado. It's that step onwards, you know. And if you didn't have it, we'd be probably buying American.
So there you go. Things you'd never knew about.
Went off on a bit of a tangent there.
Keeping the British end up.
Well done, Tim.
Things you never knew about.
Hi, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian. And with me is
Max Flight. And we're both from the Airplane Geeks podcast.
And we're so crazy about UAVs that we've decided that we needed to start a whole new podcast. Yes, folks, you're going to get an extra half hour a week of Max and I.
Yeah, David and I have been hard at work producing this new podcast that focuses exclusively on unmanned aerial vehicles and systems. And as David mentions, it's a weekly show, 30 minutes in length. We bring you news and opinions and industry experts.
And we've already talked about some very cool stuff. We've had a former Airplane Geeks guest, Jamie Dotson, on, as well as we have talked about UAVs staying aloft at 65,000 feet for 5 years. And we're trying to put a positive spin on UAVs. We're not trying to talk strictly about military uses, but the commercial uses as well.
So we invite you to take a look at the UAVdigest.com and give us a listen.
Or download us from iTunes. So we look forward to your feedback and hope you enjoy our new podcast. Again, that's the UAVdigest.com.
Velocity 14.04, Melbourne Centre.
Send us 6,000, clear to Charlie.
John Files from this heading, descend 2,000 and cleared to visual approach from established on the Puppy Jet 1751.
Solid Express 4, contact departures 129.4.
129.4, Solid Express 4.
Velocity 692, descend to flight level 250 when ready.
Descend flight level 250, leaving flight level 410, velocity 692.
Velocity 692.
13355, descend 635. 531, leaving flight level 360.
It's 531, descend to flight level 190.
Descend to flight level 190, just 531.
105, JX 751.
Plus 821, reduced to 180 knots.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the get involved and feedback section of the show. On the web, in a recent episode on scariest aircraft, I named the A-10. And there is an awesome video on the Aviationists website, which we'll put a link to in the show notes for you. We received an email from Chris Howard Bath, otherwise known as SoapyHB. And he refers to the last episode on runway headings. And he says, you posed the question, why are runway headings magnetic, not true? And we gave a lot of interesting information about magnetic variation, etc. But he doesn't believe we answered the question we'd asked. So should the answer be something like this? By the way, Chris, that's very nicely put. Chris says runway headings are magnetic because navigation pre-GPS and fancy gear was always based on the magnetic compass. The magnetic compass was the only navigation aid around for centuries. From the first time that little bit of metal sitting on a cork in a bowl of water guided Vikings and pirates across vast oceans up to the first introduction of INS, IRS and GPS, the humble compass has always been the foundation of navigation. Even the mighty 747 has backup instruments that include a little magnetic compass in the case of a total instrument failure, so they know which way they're going. Of course, all the information you discussed is applicable. I believe the answer to your original question on why runway headings are magnetic is because all navigation is magnetic. So that's why runway headings are aligned magnetic, not true. Please correct me if I'm wrong. He couldn't bear to leave that. He did sign off, but he sent us another email saying, and just one more small piece of interest regarding degrees magnetic versus degrees true. Some of you may know he is an air traffic controller in Australia, and he says our radar screens for en route control cover a large range up to 700 nautical miles, which includes up to 5 magnetic variations. So our screens are oriented to true north. The approach control screens cover a small range of about 40 nautical miles, and their screens are oriented to degrees magnetic. Bet you didn't know that. And all our radar consoles are aligned with the magnetic variation for Melbourne. But I think this is a bit of an urban myth, so they could line up the radar centre with the roadworks. One of your many humble listeners in Australia, Chris. Chris, thank you very, very much for responding and putting us right on that one. I'm sure we were pretty close, but we really appreciated you adding that detail. So thank you very much.
Presumably all their screens are upside down there, though, are they? Sorry, Chris.
Neil Braden, of course, pilot_NGB, has released a video on YouTube, which is his first 100 hours as pilot in command. Neil's a regular supporter of the show. He's gone through the journey of flying in Europe and then in the USA, gaining his license, and now he's contemplating coming back in about a year's time. So we'll put a link to that video in the show notes. If you're learning to fly in the early stages of flying, or thinking about learning to fly, it really is quite inspirational and worth a look. So please help Neil get the number of hits up to 1,000. I think he's certainly gone through the original 100 hits he was looking for. On Twitter, now we had a message from a listener, and unfortunately I do apologize, but I've lost the listener's name, but it's a question to us, and it says, who asked what new aircraft first flights do we expect to see in 2014?
Tronis.
Ooh.
No. Well, we've got the MRJ lined up, Mitsubishi MRJ. Yeah. We've also got Cessna's Latitude. That's a biz jet. That's supposed to be flying in the first quarter of next year. And also, it's not a first flight as such, but it's going to be a big, big milestone if Virgin Galactic begins its first commercial space flights in 2014.
Yeah.
That is really going to be pretty amazing. First commercial space flights.
Also on Twitter, Thomas Pitts sent us a message saying, thank you for keeping me entertained with episode 17 during my flight back from Malta this morning. I think Thomas is editing his photos, so we expect to see some really good stuff from the air show there from you very, very soon. Aviation Photographic on Twitter tweeted us saying they heard about the Cape Town to Goodwood flight in a Stearman, and it sounds like an awesome adventure. So thank you very much, Aviation Photographic, for that. And of course, we had Amy's challenge on the last show, which was all about best air show music that hadn't been used so far. Our good friend Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under said that, did he mention he used to be a DJ? Which I think was an interesting point, but yes, you have. Thank you very much, Grant. Good music choices, been using a few on our airshow audio. Didn't see the Olympics, but anything by Underworld is great. He also sent us a link to a Plane Crazy Down Under show, which featured the Box Kite team. And I think, Tim, you mentioned them. Was it Tim or Gareth?
That was me, I think.
Yeah, we mentioned them in the last show. So we'll put that link in the show notes for anyone interested. Back to Amy's challenge. Stephen Taylor said the theme from Harry's Game by Clannad for a Majestic Warbird display, and AWOL Nation Sail for a Fastjet high energy display.
Good shout.
Yeah. Elliot, our good friend Elliot Mars, said Hymn to the Fallen by John Williams for a Mustang on Mustangs display. And Hugh Hopkins also thought that was a good choice. And Niergo, N-I-R-G-O, said he'd like to see Satch Boogie by Joe Sastrani. Now, he's a new listener, so welcome to the show. And he's a 737 pilot, flies out of Birmingham. Oh, yeah, cool. Birmingham, I think. So good luck to you, Niergo.
Give us a wave.
Yes, yeah, very much so. Gareth, you also had an interesting swap of emails with Raj Patel and Sally House, who were trying to identify your guest for the next episode of Extended. And of course, we did have a bit of a teaser in our Things You Never Knew About, talking about the shuttle. Our next episode will be a space-focused episode. We've got some absolutely fabulous guests lined up for you and some great content. It will be a long episode, but it really will be packed full, so looking forward to that. Not sure if we can tell our listeners who our guests are yet.
Well, that one did get guessed in the end, so I guess it's out there, isn't it?
Is it? Okay.
I mean, so we have this discussion live on air, if you like. Now that it's in the bag and it's done, I'm quite happy with that. I was just worried about giving specific details and then it not happening for some reason.
Well, so, why don't we tell the listeners who we've got lined up for our space episode?
Okay, well, I will just reveal the sort of specific bit that I've been very, very
our
lucky
star guest
to do. One of them. Star being the operative word. And that is Mike Mullane. And Mike flew three times on the space shuttle. Prior to that, he flew 134 missions over Vietnam, was a backseater in the RF-4C Phantom. But most importantly for our next episode, I spoke to Mike, who was at home in Albuquerque, and we just talked space shuttle and astronaut stuff, basically. And anyone who knows his book, Riding Rockets, will probably have a pretty good feel for what that interview's like. And it was brilliant. Really enjoyed it.
The funniest book about space flight and astronaut corps ever.
Yeah, no question.
It is great. We've also got Roland White coming back onto the show, and Roland is doing some work on a space-related book, so we hope to bring you the latest on developments with that. And we also welcome back Gene McCulker from Talking Space, who we hope will be giving us a roundup of all that's been going on since our last space focused episode. So we're really excited about that. But let's get back to this show. And we're still in the Get Involved on our Facebook page. Joe Chung posted us a photo and said, I thought I'd share a photo of the BAE 146, the RJ100. Of QQ101. He loves the BAE 146s, and I will say it's a great photo. So thank you very much, Joseph, for posting that. Also on Facebook, we had Jason Kamlick, who posted us a video of a Buccaneer flyby. He said, you guys on the other side of the pond might enjoy this. I think Jason originates in North America, so thank you very much for that. And also on Facebook, this is one for you, Gareth. Gar retweeted a picture of two French aircraft with spectacular paint schemes, and I've got to say, one of my favorite all-time air-to-air shots.
Was that Rafale and Mirage 2000?
I think it was, yeah.
I think from the top of my head, yeah. That was Tiger schemes.
Yeah, they were. Yeah. They were. Yeah. If we're allowed to, we'll repost that one on our Facebook page and in our show notes. It's a great photo. Great photo.
Clear for takeoff, KLM 15.
November 2, cross runway 27.
November.
Delta
231.
Delta 231 behind KLM Airbus coming from behind the building. Taxi to runway 24 Sierra 6.
Behind KLM 2406, Delta
230. Airhop 3383, standby 121-8.
Standby 121-8.
2535, behind company, taxi to runway 1-5, off the road.
Yeah. I'm crossing 121-8, please.
Goedemiddag, 1986,
89. 1986, goedemiddag, number 1.
Number 1.
767, give way to the Sunweb.
Give way to the Sunweb, Kenneth, 767.
Alitalia 107, contact tower, 119.225, bye.
119.225, Alitalia 107, bye-bye.
Transavia 6411 at Alpha 10, give way to the Sunweb. Airhop 3383, taxi to Echo 5, hold short.
Echo 5, hold short, please.
Transavia 5423,
small at Echo. For you, the beginning, please, due to sequence.
Ground Jordanian 152 by Alpha to November 2 to cross short runway 27.
A-firm, right turn here.
Okay, thanks.
KLM 767, standby, Amantra 107, bye-bye.
Then, finally, before we go, promoting aerospace. Tim, do you have an aerospace topic you want to promote?
Yeah, I'd like to flag up the Aerobility charity. They do a lot of work in getting disabled and less abled people to fly. Do an amazing job. I was lucky enough to kind of go and sort of get involved in a project with them last year of a Around the World charity sim flight challenge. And they're having an aviator's ball on Saturday, 30th of November. Their website is Aviator's Ball. If you want to go there and support it or sponsor it or buy tickets, head on over and give Aerobility some support.
Okay, Tim. Gareth, do you have a topic you'd like to promote?
Yeah, it's just I make no apologies for plugging something that we've plugged and indeed featured on Extended before, but it is a bit of a news update, so I think I can get away with it. Just last week, I was very lucky. Well, not very lucky. I went down to the British Air Display Association end of season symposium, which was at the Shrivenham Defence Academy. And one of the people in attendance was Flight Lieutenant Jamie Norris, this year's Typhoon display pilot. And Jamie came down to share some feedback from the season, talk through any issues. You know, this is all about making things safer and smoother for future shows and future pilots and such like. And indeed, Jamie presented on his season. What he was also able to do, which was brilliant, was introduce me to Flight Lieutenant Noel Rees, who's next year's Typhoon display pilot. Noel, it turns out, is a former Tornado F3 pilot, and because everybody keeps telling him, he's under no illusions that he's got quite big shoes to fill next year. And that's partly, I think, because Jamie is constantly telling him that, to be honest. I know you're going to be as good as I was. And we had a really good chat. Noel is, sort of same cut of cloth, if you like, as Jamie. He's a good guy. He's going to have a good season. And interestingly, Jamie tells me his display is going to be quite different. He's gone for a slightly different approach. So looking forward to that. But best of luck to Noel, who I know will start working up in the new year. And I'm sure we'll be able to feature Noel a bit more, on Extended come 2014. And at Typhoon Display on Twitter, which is still Jamie's because he's off to the likes of Bahrain and such like to finish his season off. And you can find RAF Typhoon Display on Facebook as well.
Great stuff.
Great one. I have a small mention for a tweet or a Twitter account that I came across a week or two ago called Glorious Rex. And unfortunately, none of us like to see aircraft in a poor state of repair. But whoever runs this site posts a photo a day normally of old aircraft wrecks in situ. And there's some great stuff, particularly old Soviet and Russian relics that are in places and in states of disrepair. So we'll put a link to that. It's at Glorious Rex. Interesting little Twitter feed and has some interesting photos on there. So that's my shout out for this program. Okay, it's time to wrap up for this episode. Just before we go, we were hoping to have David Cianciotti with us on the show today. Unfortunately, due to some technical challenges, we've not been able to have David join us. So we do hope that we'll be able to bring David along to another episode of Extended at a later date. So we'd like to thank White Hearts, Peter Dixon and Live ATC for their contributions, and of course Skyrocket Cafe for supporting Extended. Now remember, if you're buying anything online, particularly in the run-up to Christmas, please go through our Amazon link on our website. Costs you nothing other than a few seconds to click through. I did it yesterday. We've got some recommendations on there. If you don't like the recommendations, just click on the Amazon name and you'll go through to the generic site. It gives us a small allowance, which, as Gareth mentioned at the start of the show, helps to contribute to the production. So we're very grateful for Global Aviation Resource for their ongoing IT support and all the support they give us in terms of hosting. But we need to be a bit more self-sufficient. So anything we can do and anything that you can do will be very gratefully appreciated. We'd also like to thank Brian Link for his time earlier this month and for persevering with that terrible line. Show notes for this episode with the accompanying pictures and links for the topics can be found on our website. And of course, that's aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on Extended. You can also find them on our Facebook page. Do follow us on Twitter. We're Aviation Extended. And Gareth, where can we find you online?
Yep, all the GAR stuff is at globalaviationresource.com. And if you would like to see what I'm blathering on about on Twitter, you can find me at Gareth_Stringer.
And Tim, well, how about you?
You can find the Royal Aeronautical Society at www.aerosociety.com. And I'm wittering on Twitter at RASTimR.
And you can find me, Nascot Hornet, on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk, as well as facebook.com/xtpmedia. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Goodbye, thanks for listening.
And it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye all, see you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. And remember to stay tuned into this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio programme. And of course, we're still the ETOPS aerospace programme.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
What's going on? You know, Skype just might be having one of its...
It's a storm!
Yeah.
It could be the weather, I suppose.
It could be, yeah.
I know next to nothing about any of them.
What? So... Well, neither do I, which...
got Tim Robinson, that's all I can
say. Worst livery rebrand ever, according to the Chicken Works. And in the show today, we talk to Brian Link, who's a director at Slipstream. It's going to be one of those.
Apart from sort of, you know, a couple of dingoes and a kangaroo. You know, it keeps... It's the... Crevice is a dirty word. Security's not a word, dirty word, Blackadder.
Tim, do you have an aerospace pop?
Yeah. Well,
sorry.
I've got...
Tim, are you on an aerospace podcast?
I'll do that again.
We can even sing the song if we want.
We're right behind you, Gareth.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.